So just like cool. Ding, ding.
Okay.
Because there's nothing worse than like sort of going, oh no, they missed off the first bit of when they started to talk. I was trying to make a video of a thing that Dave Lee did the other day, and he did this sort of like really good reading from his book, like really perfect for about 4 minutes, excellent. And then he presses stop as he says the last word.
It's like ripping the last page out of the book.
Yeah, just like how much does it cost to like leave? He's recording it on his laptop. It's like, and he's just like, the great mystery.
Fuck.
Brilliant. Wow.
So yeah, so leave lots of lead in time.
Okay, so that's
make
nice.
Plenty
good.
Of space.
No, that's really good. It sort of segues things in. That's nice. Yeah, it's a good thing.
Tell us about your art. Tell us about what you've been making.
So
please.
So the Murakamis have this thing where they dream about a tree, and then once they've dreamt about it, what they do is they go to find that tree in the physical world, and they go and find the tree, and they see in the tree the musical instruments that they can make from that tree, and then they cut down the tree, and then they make this little charanga, like little guitar, and they make this little violin.
Ooh.
It's a little tiny violin that sounds goes really high pitched. And they play these, but they're actual instruments. They play them and sing, and there's a little dance that you do when they're playing their songs and stuff. They're really cool.
And it comes from the dream.
And it comes from the dream. Oh, so there's been this initial dream. And so I had this dream of this ash tree. And in this ash tree, and it was at planet Earth, the sort of Living Well Centre, that sort of that place where I've got my own outdoor studio, and in this ash tree there was this bow, and so I went and I got the ash tree, and then we cut it down last, so it would be now, so 2017, so it would be winter 2014 to 15, and so I cut this branch and I started to make this bow, and so I made this bow, and so it's a 50-pound longbow, 28 inches, so it's tuned bow. So it's one piece of ash, and then I've carved the ends, and each of the ends that I've carved is an animal to represent the four different directions. So you've got a frog, you've got a wolf, you've got an owl, and you've got a snake.
So and two animals on each end.
Two on each end for the knocking.
Knocking. So the notch in between.
So the notch
two.
Where the string goes, yeah. So, and these ends. And then what I did was I was researching Native American. There's a North Dakota Sioux design for bow carrying equipment, which is basically a strap that you can put up and around one shoulder. You carry it a bit like a satchel bag, but you've got your bow, so you have a stick that this strap attaches to, which hangs by your side. So if you're on a horse, you can carry this bow by the side of you with this quiver next to it on this stick, and you can draw it from the horse. You don't have to get off the horse to draw the bow, knock an arrow and shoot it. So you can do it all from being on the horse. But it also means that if you've not got a horse, you can put it across your shoulders, have the bow behind you against your lower back, and the quiver, and you can run across.
Yeah, because you can run then.
And
so
it's about
if it's
planes.
On the side then, it doesn't work. But if you're running, you need it across here
so you can sort of keep your arms free and your legs free. But it then sticks out either side of you. So it's designed for planes and not wooded areas, because obviously to work with like that, you can't do it. But it's the perfect carrying equipment. So
you had the bow already.
While I was making the bow, I was sort of researching this, and this came up, and it was just like, wow, okay, yeah, this is the most practical way of having a bow and a set of quivers with arrows, and being able to carry it as a fully realised item. But it was then this process of, right, okay, how am I going to make this thing? So it's like, fucking hell. Okay, so I've got this bow, and then I was with the bow, you've got the carved nocks at either end, and then on the reverse, so I start to decorate this bow, and I was looking at then patterns. There's some Northwest American bow design patterns where they used to paint their bows. They used to paint the front of them. So instead of it, because normally if you're going hunting, you have like camouflage bows, because obviously it's this big thing to break up the shape of the bow when you hide or whatever. But the Native Americans were doing this, 1,000 years ago. And so they've got these earth pigment designs, they're like abstract zigzags and stuff, up, down the length of the bow, or some of them are different pattern designs, but they're all like geometric designs. So they're like triangles coming in from either side, all the way down, with like a line up the middle, or do you know what I mean? It's like they're really symmetrical geometric designs. And so it's like these brilliant things. So I designed this whole thing like chevrons and checkerboard design to break up the bow. But then I had to go and get the earth pigment to make the pigment. So everything's from first principles. So the whole bow is made from first principles to a great extent. There are a couple of exceptions. But so I had to go and get the pigment for this to make up the oil paint to be able to paint the bow, to paint the designs on. So I went to, I got some Biddeford black, and I'd got this, and some earth green pigment that I'd picked up. And so I got these things together and then painted this bow. But on the back, I realised that what I needed to do was to draw rune and do some runic stuff on the back. So you hold the bow in the middle of the bow, and so where you put your hand is going to be pressing up against this rune. Mm-hmm. So I put an ash rune on the back, so an ask rune. And ask was the first man that was created out of a log by Odin and his two brothers Vili and Ve, and so they'd killed Ymir and created all the world from Ymir's body, essentially. Yeah, the whole material,
his sky and the brains
of his clouds. And so essentially what it is that it's this physical world, material world that we have, everything that's material that we have is made up of Ymir. We are Ymir. All of us are Ymir's body. Created all the physical stuff we're made of is made from Ymir's body. And so it's like, but then, and so the two logs washed up on the beach where Odin and Vili and Ve were, and out of them, I can't quite remember the story, so out of them, did they carve the people? They carved the logs. So they carved the logs, and one of them was an ash log, and the other one was an elm log. And so they called them Ask and Embla.
Mm-hmm. First man and woman.
First man and woman are the ash and the elm. And so this was made out of ash wood, and so it was the ash rune. So it's like the first, it's like connecting right the way back to that first human being, to the first human being. So there's something very special about that, and it's, and so the person puts their hand up against it. And so what I did was I did the blood sacrifice and put the blood on the rune, and then said some prayers and said some things about what this was about. And then got some leather that I'd had sort of left over from an old leather jacket, and I created this sort of handle for the bow, and so it half covers the rune, so that it's half covered by the handle, but you can still see it, so you still know what you're looking at. You still know what you're looking at when you're looking at the bow. And so through the process of making this bow and these arrows, and so like all of the parts and all of the stuff that I needed to make it were sort of created where I could from first principles.
What did you make the string out of?
Yeah, the string was a tricky one. So what I ended up doing, because you can, I think what I'm going to have to do is grow some flax to be able to make the string out of.
Yeah.
But because I want it to be a functioning piece, it's really tricky, like linen strings.
Not really difficult these days.
Nobody grows linen for bowstrings anymore, and so you don't really get the length of the you want properly. Yeah. You want like proper 8 foot long, straight.
You need much longer than you end up with.
Yeah, because you can twist it, so you're going to braid it. So I ended up using dacron, but I went to, I had to learn how to make strings, like make proper bowstrings. So I went to my mate Carol from Carol Archery. She's an amazing woman. She's been the field archery champion for, like, she was like for 17 years or something. She was like, she's won it loads of times, like the UK champion field archery. And she's got a little business where she makes her own arrows, makes bows, does all this stuff. Yeah, please. And I met her at a bow making workshop with Hilary Greenland, which is a whole different story about it. She's a bowyer, and she taught me how to make bows. I went on one of her courses, and Carol was there, and I just thought, oh wow, yeah, I'd really like to connect with her and learn some stuff from her because she's got loads of skill. So she taught me how to make strings. So I had to learn to make. So this is the string I made with Carol. So it's like the first string. Cool. So for me, there's a whole imagery. So I made it. She's got her little place is like in this stable in South. Where is it? It's near Guildford. Like it's in Surrey, and it's in this old stable. So it's this long thin room with like, and it's just full of stuff, like full of archery stuff. Like arrows are all in. Like things
it's
that
all
she's
in
got.
Racks
yeah, all
stuff.
In racks.
Yeah.
And then there's a workbench with like stuff all over it, and there's like. And then, all that sort of stuff. So it's a fantastic little place. So I made the string with her and then learnt to serve it. And so there's a whole way to tie the string together and knot it. And it's the tricky thing is, because it's got two loops on it, it's to get the string the right length.
Yes.
That is what you're paying.
It has to hold the bow in the right tension.
Because it's got to hold the bow in the right tension. And so at, when you pull the bow, so as when you string the bow to start off with, there's got to be a fist meal between the edge of the bow, the belly of the bow, which is like the inside of the bow, and the string, where the string lies across it, and it's a fist and a thumb. So a fist meal is a fist and a thumb. But you've got to get the string exactly the right length to be able to get that. Because if it's too high, it's bracing like it's too high, and if it's too low, it's not going to work. And you only get one shot at it. It's like, wow. So it's like a real art of like making the string. So we made the string, and then we make it. So we made the bow, which is like days of sort of shaving it down. So you start off with a log, and you chop that log with an axe. First of all, split the log. So you use wedges and an axe to split the log. And so you then split the log, you dry it out for a year, and then you start to fashion it. And then, so you get an axe, and you chop back with an axe, and so then you draw the design on the front of the bow. And then you can chop the back out, because essentially a bow's like a stick that's 9/10 broken, so it's like it's only that thick. So it's like going from something that's like 4 inches thick to something that's probably about 7 mil. Yeah, and if you take too much off, you fuck it. Like you can't do. You've got to get. So you start off with an axe, then you go into like sort of rasps, and then you go from rasps into really fine draw knife stuff, spoke shave stuff, and then you start to go from that. So it takes days of just shaving down this one bit of wood, then putting it on a tillering stick, and then putting it down, checking the tension, and gradually adding, taking a bit off here and a bit off there to then change the tension so you get this perfect sort of half moon. When the bow's actually strung, it's like it should be a perfect half moon. And so it takes days of doing this shit, man. It's hard work, and it's like, oh man. So there's all that process with making the bow. And then making a little arrow shelf. So I then had to get some.
You've then got to make the arrows.
You've got to make the arrows. But then, and all these, there's little tiny details on the bow. So you put an arrow shelf made out of whole antler. So you have to get the antler.
Yes.
Then you have to saw it. Then you have to saw it down, and then you have to saw it into place, and then fit it, and then sand it. Then you're not even starting the arrows. You're not even halfway there. And it's like, so this takes months, man. Then you've got 12 arrows. So there's a set of 12 arrows. So traditionally there's 12 arrows. It's got to be 12. It's got to be a dozen. And so each arrow is then chosen by getting a hazel. So I used hazel. And so what you do is choose long, straight hazel. You choose your hazel. You cut it. You then bundle it all up. And then you hold it for a year. And you store it for a year before you can even touch it. Then you start to take the skin off it after a year, and then you start to have to straighten them over a fire, gradually, bit by bit, heating the sap up.
Sort of half steaming.
So yeah, so you half steam it, and sort of, yeah, exactly. And then you sort of let that steam settle in that position. Yeah. So you've got this whole process. That's just the arrow shafts.
Yeah.
Then what you do is you have to put each arrow. So once you've got the shaft, you've then got to start sanding it. So you've got to get it perfectly smooth, like all the way over. And then what you do is you tune the thickness of the arrow to fit the bow. So what you have is, for say, a 50-pound longbow at 28 inches
mm-hmm.
has a particular flex. So the arrows flex as they leave the bow. The arrows flex in and out. And that's what gives them the push. Them. Yeah, it's what gives them the velocity. And so if it's a thinner arrow, it's going to flex more.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to tune it. And so, but if I'm shooting a 120-pound longbow and the arrow is really thin, it's going to be flexing all over the place because of all the force that's been shoved into it. So, you know, if the more powerful the bow, the stiffer the arrow's got to be able to get a straight shooting arrow. So you have to tune the arrows to the bow. So each single shaft of those 12 shafts, you have to shave it down and then test it. And you have to put a 2-pound weight in the middle of it and put two rests in at the length of the arrow length. 28 inches and then you weight it so that it flexes at the right amount, and then you take it and you go, right, okay, that was flexed, and you sand it,
so it's completely smooth.
That's your stick.
okay
that's then... your stick. Then you have to cut
year one.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like it goes on. It's like the amount of it's like a whole story in just of this whole thing. And so you've got to put, you put antler inserts into each arrow. So, which basically means where the string is attached to the wood of the bow, so where the arrow goes onto the string, yeah? There's like a little notch called a knock, yeah? Now, the trouble is, if you just do that into wood, what happens is
it splits
off, they knock off, because, hence the name, which means then you've got to recut them, and then and gradually the arrow gets shorter and shorter and shorter. So you want to prevent that. So what you do is you put antler again, you cut slithers of antler and you insert them into the end of the arrow. So you have
it's
to
like
cut
a
down.
V-shape bit of antler, or is it just
a it's a strip.
Bit.
And so what you do is you have to saw, so you have to get your arrow vertical and before you cut the actual knot where the string goes, at 90 degrees to that, you cut the first strip and it goes down about 2 inches.
Yeah.
You insert your arrow, your horn insert, shave it, sand it all down, so glue it in. Glue it together, sand that all down so it fits the profile of the arrow. Then you turn it 90 degrees and you cut your knock for the string. Because then what does it? It's like a reinforcer for the wood to stop it splitting.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's when... You do that for 12 arrows.
Mm-hmm.
So then you start painting them. So then I started painting them. And each of the different arrows has got a different painting design, depending on its personality.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way to find out what the personality of the arrow is, you have to tune into the arrow and you have to listen to what it says to you. So you've got to spend a long time. But it's a bit like dealing with animal skins. Mm-hmm. If you ever dealt with animal skins, you end up, because you're working physically with this material. So in this case, you're working with the wood of the arrows, you're sanding it down, you're carving it. You spend so much time with it. Is that then suddenly you get, each one's got a different personality, got a little kink here and there, there's little marks on each one, you know, so you know every arrow, you know each one, and you know if it's slightly a bit too flexible and, you know, just about right, or, you know, so you get to know them. And so they've all got personalities. So I ended up painting the visual representation of the spirit on each arrow. So they're all spirit arrows. So basically they've all got personality, and there's one that's got... that's the death arrow. It's got loads of death. It's got loads of... It's the arrow for the dead, for the ancestors. And it's got lots of... It's got skulls on it.
Mm-hmm.
So once you've got the... painted all the designs on it, which are all done with, like, natural pigments. So you paint them all with natural pigments. You've then got the fletchings to put on.
Mm-hmm.
So the fletchings are then... Like, we've got this thing, is that we've got these geese. So they've got these geese on the pond in Pendeen. And we know the person who keeps them. They kill them every Christmas because, well, you know, they have them as pets, but then they also, you know, they sort of kill them. And so we got the goose wing feathers. Now, the things with the fletchings is there's a whole thing with the fletchings is that they've got to be of the same wing from the same bird, because then the right, because they, if you think about the way the feathers go on the wings, some are curved that way and some are curved this way, so they're sort of opposite to each other. So you've got to get them off the same wing, so they all go in the same direction.
Same curve. Yeah.
So it's got the same curve. So it's got the same. Yeah. Well, it's not. It doesn't have to be the same bird. Sorry, okay. But it just have to be off the same wing. So either the left wing or the right wing. And so we've got two white goose feathers. So we've got these goose feathers. You get these fletchings. You then have to strip. You have to put a knife down the middle of the fletching to strip it. Then you shave that off so it's flat onto the arrow. Then you can cut. Then you cut down and get the right fletchings sort of length. Then to glue it onto the arrow, because there's three fletchings. They've all got to be at 120 degrees away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, how do you do that accurately? Because working with them is really difficult because they bend.
And as soon as you touch it, it just goes vroom into
It just go into a spiral.
Yeah.
So you sort of go, fuck, how do you deal with that? So then you've got a whole thing about how you, each time, and what it is each time you're doing this process is that you come across problems that you know they were the same problems that people faced 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought in exactly the same way and came up with their own innovative solutions to do that. And so you get a fletching jig, which basically is a two bits of metal with ball bearings in it, and you put the fletching into that. It clamps it, so it keeps it straight. You can then glue it, and then there's a fantastic bit of a bit of angling, simple technology. So what you do is in the end of the arrow, you put a piece of slot of wood with an arrow on it. And then you position on the edge of the fletching jig. There are three positions, one, two, and three.
Brilliant.
And so what you do is, because it's in the nock of the arrow, you turn the arrow to position one, you glue your first fletching on, yeah? You take it out, you let it settle, you turn the arrow to position two, you get your second fletching in between your bits of metal, you put it on into position two, and then position three. Amazing bit of kit, fantastic. That's cool. So you get your fletchings glued on, and then because it's like hide glue, yeah, so made out of rabbit skin.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got rabbit skin, you take the rabbit skin, you cut the rabbit skin up, you boil it, and you let it boil off until it goes all mushy, and then you let it settle, and then you boil it all the way down to the bottom so it's like glass, then you smash it up, that's your rabbit skin, then you rehydrate it to make rabbit skin glue.
Wow.
With hot water. And so then you put that on your fletching. And then you glue your fletching down, but it's not waterproof because obviously it gets wet again. It's not that waterproof. It can come off. They get submerged in water. It's not good for them. So then you have to tie each set of three fletchings on the arrow. So you bind them on. So there's a particular way to do it where you end up with a thread, probably about 4 or 5 feet long. And you start to twist the arrow and you've got to get the binding thread, in between the veins of the feathers,
mm-hmm.
and you've got to get exactly right so that there's four turns per inch. Okay, so four turns per inch. So if you start to go off, you're fucked because it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. It's really difficult to bring it back down without it all going like this all over your arrow. So it's like, man, so you have to learn how to do all that. Man, and then basically, once you've got that, you've got to then varnish the arrows.
Mm-hmm.
So the arrows need varnishing because they're not waterproof, so they need to be waterproof, so you've got to varnish the arrows. So you've got your fletchings on, you've got your nock cut, you've then just got the pointy bit at the end to sort out. And it's like, that went through fucking months of dilemma over that. It was like, I went on the flint knapping course with Will to get to flint knap glass, because you can knap glass.
Yep.
But what I realised with the knap glass is that the arrowhead's quite thick, like, because it's the thickness of the glass. And so what you want to do is, and you can't do it with thin, it's really difficult with thin glass, it's so fragile. So you've not got the strength of like flint or something that you sort of, so it's really tricky to nap glass. It's, I can see how it's really difficult. And so in the end, I got I've got three different sets of medieval arrowheads sorted. One of them were, I got them from Victor Mead's Forge, which is like a classic forge. You know, these arrowheads are worth like 20 quid each. They're like just arrowheads. It's like, wow, man.
They're like hand-forged.
They're hand-forged. Yeah, by Oliver Mead. And And so they're hand forged. So three of them are armor piercing arrowheads. So they're like death weapons. They're just functional for piercing chainmail armor. So so you've got your links of chainmail, and the arrowhead's designed to go in, split the chainmail, and carry on penetrating through whatever, and through plate mail as well, and through plate.
Like a bullet shape, kind of.
They're like, almost like an, they're like a flower petal shape, but in the square. Does that make sense? So it's like they're four-sided, so very like narrow, like torpedo heads is what they're like, but four-sided. So they're there for armour piercing. And then three of them are hunting broadheads, which are basically the classic sort of triangle-shaped heads, and they're sort of quite long and big. So they've all been sharpened. Then you've got to sharpen them. So the armour-piercing ones, you don't have to, but the other ones have got to sharpen them. So it's getting files out, then it's getting gradually, you know, sharpening until they're razor sharp. And then four of them are target heads, which are like squarer, stouter, and they're, you know, they're a bit more like for impact rather than for piercing. So they're just, you can use them for also hitting sort of small game and things like that, because they're sort of more, they're more with a square. So getting these heads, getting them on, fitting them on, nailing them in, doing that. So that's the arrows. Mm-hmm. So then you do that, and that's your arrows sorted. Hey! Then you've got all your leather work to do.
Yeah, because once you've got these objects, you're going to have to put them in something.
So then you've got to protect them. Because it's like you've got these 12 arrows. You can't carry them around in your hand and stuff. No. I mean, you can hunt with three and just have them in your hand, it's fine. But you want to be carrying 12, and you want them, you're going to be carrying the travelling with them.
But we've got, hang on, I just want to go back. We've got armour piercing. We've got
hunting broadheads.
Hunting broadheads.
And the squarer ones.
The squarer target arrows.
There's four of each.
There's four of each of them, not three.
Right,
okay.
Thank you. Yeah, that's
three sets.
Yeah, three sets of four. Thank you.
But let's go back. Okay, we'll go on, rather, to the container.
So you've got your shape that you've already decided.
So you've got your bow, you've got your string, you've got your arrows. Yeah? It's like, fuck, I've got to protect them all now. So what do you do? So, okay, so North Dakota Sioux, carrying thing. Brilliant. Yeah, I can do that. I'll make one of those.
You've got to make it out of something.
But you've got to make it out of something. So the dream is that it's not made out of deer skin or some floppy leather. It's made out of really good quality English bridle leather.
Yeah.
So the only place that's left in England that makes oak bark tanned leather is in Devon. Is F.J. Baker and Son in Devon. And that's a whole experience. Just ordering the leather is like a whole experience on its own. Because this place is following the same pattern that it has done since the 17th century. It's the same building. They've got these big oak vats in the floor of like one whole room of this place that are just sunken pits full of these different dyeing solutions with like different oak bark solutions in them, that they've had shipped from Rebecca Oaks in Cumbria, who every year gets one big truck full and sends down all her oak bark that she's collected that winter to this place, and they just use that for the whole year for just tanning these, making these big tan vats. And there's one guy there that works, and his job is just scraping hides. So they get the hides in, he just scrapes all the fat and all the sort of stuff that's left on the skin off these hides. He's done that job for 20 years. Just doing that.
Wow, cool.
It's quite hard work.
Wow, man, it's really hard work. And quite skilled, really skilled.
Because you have to get it down to the right amount. You have to take it all off, and you have to get it really
not
even.
Not too
so
much.
Because
it's really easy to get holes in it. Mm. And you can't afford to do that. You know, if it's a, you know, and because this, you know, these hides are expensive.
How long do they have to soak in the vats? How many weeks?
Well, the way that you order it is this. Is so you go, you thought, fucking, I've got a website. Amazing, brilliant. And so you go, wow, I must be able to order online. That's really weird. There's no shopping cart or anything. Fuck. And so just contact us for a quote. And so you phone them up and you realise that they've got no, like, inclinations. Somebody's made them a website because they thought obviously it's a good idea, but all their accounting systems are still stuck in the 17th century. It's like you can't pay by card on the phone. You haven't got a facility to take cards. And so what you do is you order, you say, tell us what you want. What do you want? I said, well, I'm doing this stuff. I'm making traditional archery quivers and bow bags and this sort of stuff. Ah, right, what you want is this, this. I said, well, no, I need something that's 90 inches long because the bow's so long, I need to make a bow container for it. So it's 90 inches long. Ah, yeah, well, oh, yeah, okay, all right, oh, well, okay, leave it with us. Leave it with, what? No, when can you deliver? I was going, when can you deliver it? And they were going, no, we'll get back to you. What are you talking about? That's so awesome. About 2 weeks later, nobody's contacted me. And so I phone them up. And I say, I'm just inquiring about these skins, see if you can do it, and all this sort of stuff. I say, yeah, it's going to be all right. It's going to be about 3 weeks. It's like, okay. And in the meantime, can you pay? How can I pay? You're going to have to do a check and send us a check through the post. It's like, wow, do you want like a covering letter and stuff? So you have to like send this thing off and then just wait. There's no, like, it's completely old school. Like, there's no, it's like, there's none of this internet technology, immediacy, Amazon, next day delivery. It's like, no, man, you've got to fucking wait. And so I've waited there for ages for this stuff, and still it doesn't arrive. And it's like, fucking hell. And so I phone them up and I go, look, I've ordered this stuff. Nobody's contacted me or anything to, like, say, it's going to be, you know, it's ready. It's gone past the 3 weeks that you said it was going to be. No, it'll be all right. It'll be all right. We're going to send it through. We're onto it. We're just bringing them out of the vats.
Yeah.
So it's like, wow, man. So they've got a whole thing where they have to tan it for a certain amount of time and dye it in these oak vats. And then it's like, all right, okay. And then so through the post, you get this massive roll of like leather. And it's got like, it's properly oiled greaseproof paper. Oh,
beautiful.
And it comes in this oiled greaseproof paper with like string around it. And it's like this whole package of stuff. And then you unfurl this thing and it's really heavy. These skins are massive. And it's they're like, the leather's like 3 or 4 millimetres thick.
Whoa, okay. That's really like sturdy.
It's like fucking, I was just going, fucking, I don't know how I'm going to stitch this. So I know how to do like leather stitching, like deer skin and stuff. Because it's like real rabbit skins.
Yeah, it's just like floppy.
It's floppy. Yeah, it's like, yeah. This is like, fucking hell, man. This is like, like it's bridle leather. It's like making saddles. Yeah, it's like lino. It's like, fuck. So then I have to learn how to stitch leather. So I have to learn how to hand stitch leather via books, via the internet, via talking to people who are bridle makers, all this sort of stuff. And also, it's such a big thing. So stitching the quiver is such a big thing. There's no real equipment to be able to hold it. So what you have to do is you basically need a clamp. You need to clamp two bits of the leather together side by side. And then you have two needles with linen string in between that you've got to beeswax. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, so you've got to get the linen string. You have to beeswax it all. And then you have to sort of taper the ends off, put them through a needle, tie them back, both ends. So you've got a needle either end of this string. And then what you have to do is, with a bradawl in one hand, you have to push through, so you have to clamp the leather really close to where you're
really
going to work.
Solid, so it's completely solid. Back, so
well, it's just every time you've got to put loads of force into it, so you've got to push it. You've got to push this bradawl all the way through two bits of 3 mil leather, like that. And then what you've got to do is, as you bring the bradawl back through, you push the first needle through, so it follows the bradawl back through.
Otherwise, the hole just closes up.
Otherwise, it closes up. And then, so what you then have to do is then get the other needle and then push that as it comes through. As the other needle comes through the other side, you pull it, and then you get the other needle and push it back through. Then you get both needles now in the opposite sides of the leather, and you have to pull them, and because it's like, you've got like 3 metres long length of piece of string. Pull them, and then you're ready for your next stitch.
And how far apart are these stitches?
And these stitches are 3 mil, maybe 2 mil.
Apart from each other, yeah.
Apart from each other.
Yeah. And this is 90 inches.
Is 90 inches long.
Mm, so that took you a few hours.
Fucking hell, man! And it's really cumbersome, like, because it's weighted. It's really long and weighted on one end. So you're like there. So in the end, I had to buy some saddler's clams. Now saddler's clams are for making saddles.
Okay.
And what they are is they're like, it's a 3 foot long piece of wood that splits halfway up, and then it's been steam bent ash that comes together like as if you're gonna, you know, if you put your hands together like this and make like a What's that? So how would you describe that? Like a clam shape. A clam shape with your hands. Mm. Where your fingers touch, that's where the leather goes. But these things are like really deep, so that you can get a really big, you can get a big throat, so you can get your leather in there, mm-hmm. clamp it, and do this thing. So you're like forcing, you've got all this stuff, like doing this fucking thousands of stitches all the way along this bow bag. And then you go, right, I've done the bow bag, now I've got to do the quiver.
Yep.
And so then you have to do the same thing all the way along the quiver and down the sides.
Yeah.
And then you go, wow, fucking hell, fantastic.
Mm.
How do I keep the arrows apart from each other in the quiver? Because otherwise, because it's this solid thing, stuff, they'll just all sink to the bottom of the quiver and rattle around. All feathers are going to get all caught up with each other. Yeah. Fuck. So then what I had to do is I had to go to the Mary Rose, and on the Mary Rose, the way that they dealt with separating them out is what they would have a cloth bag,
mm-hmm.
and that 2 or 3 feet long to hold all the arrows in, and probably about 6 inches from the top of it, well, probably a bit longer, it's probably about a foot from the top of this cloth bag, they have a leather disc, and in the leather disc is punched the holes that then, like, you know, 24 holes they used to have in their things, that you can put all the arrows in. And then the top of the cloth bag closes around the fletchings as a drawstring to protect them from water. So you want to be protecting them from the rain.
Accidental knocks and things.
Yeah,
and
accidental knocks, and just keep them, keep it all solid.
So they don't fall out as well.
They don't fall out, so they're not all rattling against each other. But the problem, so you think, great, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? Except the quiver that I've made, because I've had to stitch the leather together like this, it's a teardrop shape.
In profile. Yeah.
In profile, it's a teardrop shape. So now I've got to make
a disc
that fits that exactly inside the quiver. And then I've got to fix it in place as well as get canvas in there around it to then go around the top of the fletchings. So I've got to get the disc, the canvas, and everything. I've got to stitch them all together through this fucking bridle leather. And it's like, how am I going to do that? How actually am I going to do that? And so again, it's like this thing, back to the ancestors. It's like it's the same thought processes. They come across the same problems again and again. And it's how they refine that. But it's like trying to do it blind. So you've not got a dad or something.
Yeah, you can't go,
Dad, what the fuck? I've got this quiver and it's a teardrop shape. Well, it's a fucking red. Yeah, exactly. Oh, what your granddad would do is like, you know, that sort of stuff. Is that there's nobody there. It's like, so I've got to fucking go and dream it again. So I've got to go, I've got to talk to grandmother ayahuasca again and then let go, okay, I've got to dream this thing. Okay, so go and ask her and say, look, I've got this problem. I've got this fucking quiver and this teardrop shape. So she's like, so then she goes, oh, here's a vision. And he goes, oh, wow, fantastic. Wow, that's how to solve it. Brilliant. Thanks, Grandma. Like that. And then, so come back. So I made this thing, this teardrop shaped piece of leather. And I thought, well, I can't just leave it. So you're going to decorate it. So you want to make this thing beautiful. Yeah, this has got to be a beautiful object.
This is an artwork, isn't it?
Well, it's also that I'd been really obsessed with this thing of this idea of minge. You know minge?
No.
Minge, it's obviously Japanese, is that it's the thing. It's a bit like manga, but no, it's not. So what it is, it's a craft movement, and it's about zen of objects, utilitarian objects.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this whole dilemma, this whole art dilemma of craft object versus art object. What is this thing? Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested about the boundary between utilitarian craft objects, like this cup,
mm-hmm.
or... you know, this, whatever it might be, this utilitarian thing. And then where that becomes an art object, and it's something about they're useful. So it's like the bow as mm-hmm. an idea, is that mm-hmm. it's a really useful object. It was really useful in its day, but now it's sort of become not useful,
mm-hmm.
but it sort of still works. But it's mm-hmm. just not valued in the same way as it was back in the day. You know, and so there's this whole thing about, wow, it's a useful object that's sort of not useful anymore. Yeah, so it's sort of, wow, but it still works. It's like, yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And so minge is the idea that you've got a utilitarian object, and it's a Japanese sort of craft idea, sort of, and it's a bit like Zen. So it's a bit like saying every object that you have should be a beautiful object. Mm. It should be the most beautiful object that you can possibly have.
Mm-hmm. It's like the arts and crafts movement.
Yeah, it's the arts and crafts. It's the whole William Morris arts and crafts thing of saying utilitarian, beautiful objects.
It's part of it that, like, this is such a lovely thing. It works so well. I want to demonstrate how much I love it by putting lovely decorations on it. Is it that part of it?
And also, just in terms of just design, design, its form, it's how it feels in your hand.
Yep, so you go,
how it's a lovely, it's an object you love. That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And so, so really interested in that. So the whole thing with then creating these quiver cases is that it's a utilitarian, essentially it's utilitarian, but you make it beautiful. You make it as beautiful as you can. This deep, honey, chestnutty, oak bark, tanned leather that's just gorgeous. There's such a honey-coloured richness to it, to its depth of its colour.
What about the stick?
And the stick. So with this whole setup with the North Dakota Sioux, you tie the quiver and the bow bag to a stick, which then the stick is on a strap which goes around you. Yeah. So the stick. So I was thinking, oh man, I've got this, and I've had for years. Is that so? Where I grew up, where I grew up in North Nottinghamshire, is like it's before I left. I'm trying to think how. Before I left school, I asked a friend because I was training in ninjutsu. Yeah. And I asked a friend at school whose dad was a foreman down the pit to see if he could get me a pit foreman stick. Because what they had is they had a stick that was a yard long, okay? And it's sort of, it's tapered, it's got brass ferrule on one end, and it's long and straight, perfectly straight, with like a knob on the other, so you can feel which end you've got, yeah? And what they would do is, because you're down the pit, the pit foreman would need to measure, like, the length of tunnels, or the distance from a blast zone so that people could be safe. But you're down there, so you can't do a tape measure. It's really difficult doing tape measure because the pits go, it goes up and down as well as, you know, round the bends and stuff. So it's not straight roads necessarily. So what you get is you have a stick, and what you do is you walk along. And as you walk along, you rotate the stick 1 yard, 2 yards, 3 yards, 4 yards, 5 yards as you're walking along down the tunnel. And so he could measure that. So it's a pit foreman's yardstick. And this was given to me by somebody from school. And I can't remember who it was. And they gave me just before...
Why did you need it for ninjutsu?
So, okay. So my favourite weapon in ninjutsu... I mean, we've all got one, haven't we? is the hambo, which is the half bow. So the bow is a 6 foot long staff.
Uh-huh.
Okay. That you use in it, that you move in a particular way, and use it as a weapon. But it's also, a lot of them are based on Japanese agricultural implements.
Yeah.
So this is like having a rake. Yeah, it's a rake, or it's a big long thing that you can sort of wheel around, spin around, and hit people with it and stuff. Essentially, and trip them up and all sorts of stuff, put them into holes. You know, use it. But the hambo is a half size one, so it's 3 foot long. It's a 3 foot long stick, and it was my favourite weapon. I just love it because it's so utilitarian. It's a walking stick.
Yeah, you can just walk around. It's a walking stick.
It's a completely practical item, but it's got this other use. So it's got this other use. So I wanted it because I was 15 and I was into my weapons. So it's like, of course, we all were. Come on.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just me. But So I was really wanted this stick. But then it's like, you got it, and it's a bit like, not really, I can't really take it down the ninjutsu club and with my hand, but it's just because it's got brass ferrule on one end. It's like, it's not really a training thing, and it's sort of a walking stick. So I carved a snake on it and wrote, I can't remember what I wrote, some sort of weird copy, and carved into it in copper flake script. It was the first carving I ever did. And it's a coiled snake around this thing, and then it says Greg Humphreys Esquire copper plate script on the top of it, and it's just like, wow. And so I found this thing again. So I refound this thing. We were clearing all the bedrooms out for the new baby coming, and it's like, I found this thing. It's like, fucking brilliant. So that's perfect. So I can use that as the stick for tying the bow and tying the thing on there. So it's like, so that is the thing. And then decorating all the leather, so then it becomes a process of decorating all the leather, and it's like, oh man, how are we going to do that? Fuck, every single time it's like,
yeah, you can't paint it, can you?
Because it's leather. Paint it's leather, and like, leather dye doesn't really work that well. It bleeds, and it's like, this leather I've just spent 2 years making this thing, the fuck am I going to do? I can't fuck it up at the last sort of last hurdle. So it's like, oh man. And then I get one of those, what are they called? Are they called pyrographs?
Yep. Pyrography.
Pyrography. Yeah. You're like, yeah. It's like a, essentially it's like a, and Lidl's had them on special offer. So why did you know, hey. Lidl, classical, brilliant Lidl. It's like Lidl, I hate Lidl so much. It is like the...
You'll mourn it after Brexit.
I know, exactly. It's like, that's the thing. It's like, oh God. It's like just crap cheap items, isn't it? And it's but it's like actually it's occasionally, you have some really useful stuff in, like occasionally. And we randomly got through, like, or I saw, we were in a cafe or something, and somebody left one of those Lidl's shitty, like, really thin, things, yeah. Thin paper, a bit glossy, you know, like 10 page, ooh, special offers at Lidl this month, you know, that sort of thing. And in there was a pyrograph, and I thought, fuck you, yeah, that would be brilliant. That would be the thing. So we, courtesy of Mr. and Mrs. Lidl, do they, is that a real thing?
Yeah, Mr. Lidl, yeah.
Mr. Lidl, is that, yeah, so I decided to pyrograph this this thing. So created this border and hand, just did it by hand, straight off. No planning, just by hand, went on. So it is that what that classic sort of painters have this thing where they call it like the final stroke or like the dangerous stroke or the, you know, and it's basically you'd spend hours on this paint, like months on this painting, and then you go, wow, you know, it'd be really brilliant. It'd be like a massive big bucket full of red paint across the bottom half.
Yeah.
And then they go, oh my God. And then what is this? But it really worked, or it could really just fuck it all up and it'd be really horrendous. And it was a bit like that. So it was one of those moments. So it's like...
So what sort of pattern did you do?
So it's a checkerboard pattern. And I keep using this checkerboard pattern. It's like something linked to Albion. It's a very Albion-based thing. So artillery for the Herald of the New Eon. And so it's going to be the bow where I don't fire it. It's not for me. It's for the Herald of the New Eon, whoever that's going to be or whatever that's going to be. Or whatever spirit that's going to be. And I don't know who that's going to be, but it's there. And it's an object, and it's waiting for them. So we've got to wait
to see some of the strap out?
More of the leather, but I didn't have to stitch it, because it's so thick, thank God. So it's actually... Yeah. So there's this object that's waiting for somebody to come and pick it up.
Ahoy.
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 It... reminds me of so many things. I mean, there's just your it's a genuine honour to be in the presence of someone who's made a thing like that. It really is.
Thank you.
It really is, because it reminds me of so many things. It might reminds me of the Hermetic tradition of you know, there's that joke about how many Hermetic magicians it takes to change a light bulb. No, the answer is only one, but it takes them a very long time to make the light bulb. And so it's like that, because it's your precision and your tenacity and your bloody-mindedness.
OCD. Saying, I'm going to,
no, it's delightful. It's repeated as well in your use of things like the dot paintings and in the checkerboard design, because it's like repetition.
Yeah,
it's like there the is prayer repetition. Being made again and again and again. And for years, you know, I have to take this, was it hazel for the arrows?
Yeah.
I have to take this hazel and I have to plan that in a year's time I will return to this wood and I will do this work. And it's like it's that long-term kind of stuff.
Mm.
And it's, again, it also reminds me both in terms of the quality of the designs graphically and also the, again, the repetition of... things like the kind of, yeah, those psychedelic kind of visions that one gets, that sort of those iterative kind of spirals repetitive, fractal kind of things. Yeah,
that's true.
So it reminds me of all of that sort of stuff. And it also makes me think about, particularly because I you told me a little bit about the form and stick. I hadn't actually realised that, A, it was your first ever piece of carving.
I only realised that recently. Mm. Mm.
And also that, of course, it was associated with your early ninjutsu period. And
it's a warrior stick from the beginning.
And I remember, right from the beginning. I remember you saying about how you sort of like ditched ninjutsu because you wanted to sort of not be paranoid when you came into rooms about where the escape routes were and what possible weaponry there might be.
And it's like,
So you've transformed that whole thing and built it into this structure. And so, you know, I'm genuinely honoured to be in the presence of that art.
Wow,
it's amazing.
Yeah. So it's
I wanted to ask about the four animals that you carved onto the ends of the bow. What's the symbolism? Why did you pick those four? Or did they pick themselves? What was the process of that?
They picked themselves. Oh. It's like that. That was a. That's just part of the vision.
Can you remind me of what the dream?
Yeah, there's the frog.
For water.
For me, the frog is. It's the creature that can exist in water and on land. And it can cross the boundaries, so it's a boundary crosser.
Mm.
It's like powerful, you know, this world and another world, and it can also go where humans can't go. So it can go. So as an ally, it can go where you can't go, because it's too. You can't survive there for long enough.
Yeah,
you know, and so yeah, it's a really interesting medicine in terms of like Cambo, in terms of frog medicine, in terms of 5-MeO-DMT for the toad medicine. It's that amphibious sort of quality of that crossing into the other world.
It's like this, that symbol of transformation, like in the way that in the card, the tarot card, the moon, you have a lobster or a crayfish or a crab or something. It's that same sort of this animal that's a liminal kind of creature.
Yeah. Liminal, walking between the worlds.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely.
And associated with things like regeneration, and actually some of the iconography. And some of the iconography of early Christianity as well. The frog was because it sort of comes, emerges out of the ground. It's kind of, you know, reborn from the earth when the rain falls. In the Holy
Land. It's to do with death as well, because it's that whole thing, you know, like the whole Cambo medicine thing of taking you to the point where your body. So the way it works is it just reboots the whole sort of glandular and endocrine system. So you basically go through, it poisons you to the point where that goes, fuck, you're about to die. And it boosts, it just resets that. So it takes you through that death process. And then as you come out the other side, it resets itself. So you can get rid of really bad infection, you know, the stuff that's been going on for a long time through that process, both mentally, physically, and, you know, emotionally. You know, it's really interesting that the frog does that. It brings that for you as some of this transformation.
So we have a frog, and then we had
a snake.
A snake?
A snake, yeah. So the snake is the symbol, I mean, because it sheds its skin. Is that, again, it's this symbol of transformation, isn't it? So it's this thing of rebirth, eternally new rebirth, but then it's also this thing of, it's like the tricks to God as well. So it's that thing, you come and eat this apple, you know, that sort of thing. Is that, and it's benevolent. It's just that it's sort of going, look, you need to get out. It's the changer. It's the forcer of change. It's like the instigator of change. The instigator, but through that is also, through that change comes learning, comes experience, comes, you know, wisdom eventually, but it's a path up towards that. It's not instant wisdom. It's just that it puts you in situations where you're forced to change, I think. Yeah, but it doesn't do the transformation. That's the frog. It's the instigator of the transformation, I think. So it starts that sort of that change. And also, for me, it's also linked to, you know, my experiences with snake are also ones to do with facing fear. And it's also like, it's like when we're in Nepal, when we're in Nepal and we're walking up to the fucking the temple with the six-fingered man. And I think I've told you the story. Oh, man, the Shiva temple. So we're staying in Pokhara and we decided we're going to walk up to this high point, see the Annapurna Range and all this sort of stuff. Yeah, top of this mountain, bit of a mountain nearby. So we just walk up, we start to walk up this path, steps, you know, walking up this thing, really lovely actually, it's really gorgeous paddy fields to start off with, and then up through this thing, and we're walking up this path, and then suddenly there's just this fucking movement at my feet, and it was just like, fuck. And you turn around, there's this, it was big, it seemed a big snake.
It was big,
it was like six foot long
at least,
yeah, and thick, and it was just, I
did not see it. It's like that. It was just not there, and then it. I would have been dead. If it was going to bite me, I would have just been bitten.
It was
just
moved no way. So fast that it was as though it lived in another dimension, because it was so still and then so quick that we were this sort of sluggish mid-range creature, and suddenly it went sort of kind of up into a tree in this kind of bizarre sort of coiled itself up.
And so there's this, and it's that. So it's that transfer, that instigator of change and transformation that comes without any warning.
It's like there's a
no, and they have a miraculous way of moving, because they have no limbs either. Yeah. So they just move, and it's like, how did it do that?
Yeah, it's just this sort of like S-shaped worm.
It reminds me of the sort of the worms and the dragons, and of course the dragon that's also carved, the serpent rather, that's carved on the form and stick as well. So there's the
A little connection there.
Yeah.
And there's it also reminds me of that thing of I think we were talking about, it's like things again, there's like a fear element associated with that for me anyway, and so there's this thing of it could kill you.
It's a healthy fear, kill you.
Well, that's what I'm saying, it's like it is healthy fear, that's it. It's and it reminds me of that, but it also in terms of the movement, I was going to say this thing is because it moves like this. It was like, I think we were talking about this ages ago, spiders, crabs, snakes, they move in a way that's not mammalian, and so we instinctively go, what the fuck is that? it's just like, what's that thing?
I think we actually have a sort of basically a brain system that discriminates the styles of movement, and those particular styles of movement register as
you
unnerving.
Must notice this.
This is weird.
Yeah, and it's also back to that reptilian brain part of you as well.
It's not human fear; it goes back long.
Yeah, it's like that's a completely embodied fear.
When you're a little fish swimming around in the sea, it's like, fuck, there's an eel.
Yeah, and
away.
It's like it's physically in your body. It's not like a,
it's not a head thing.
I'm anxious about some, what's going to happen? It's not a head fear. It's like an instinctive. Like thing, and then it goes away. You know, it's like it's just in your body. Amazing.
So we have the leaper of faith, and with the serpent of wisdom, and then who else do we have?
So then we have the wolf. Now the wolf is an interesting one because it's not one that I have a big connection with. I'm a cat person. If anything else, my experience is cats. But with the wolf, is that. It's one thing, you know, it's the one thing that we eliminated from our surroundings. Why? Because it's really fucking dangerous.
Yeah.
And it'll hunt you. And that's the thing, is that it's the one animal. It's like in the jungle, they have this thing with the jaguar. And the jaguar is like, that's why it's seen as like the, in that whole ayahuasca vision of jaguars and stuff, is that because it's the one thing that'll track you down. So it's not just there. You come across it like a bear or something, it goes, ooh, fuck. You know, it's just, it goes, and it, no, a bear will actually hunt you, but it's like, it's not like you come across like a snake and it just jumps and gets you. It's like, it goes, oh, look at you. Yeah, that's right, I'm going to fucking follow you. I'm going to eat you. And
I'm
it just
not
hides.
Following for days.
Yeah, and you, I'll be waiting. And then the way it gets you is that it jumps at your neck and bites your head off. And just takes you off with one. So it just comes up, jumps and gets you. You don't even know it's happened. And that's why it's fucking scary.
Mm-hmm.
And so the wolf is like that, I think, but for like northern temperate sort of climates. Because
in
America
all
you get bears.
That's
wolves and bears are the two things that will actually physically, as a pack, you know, and they move as one unit.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they're one unit because they hunt together. So their survival is dependent on each other. And they tend to be mother, led by the she-wolf, and then there'll be a hierarchy of wolves that are behind them. And so it's like sort of a family, but it's sort of like this psychotic family that are going to sort of like get you, you know, by hook or by crook, one way. And it's all those folk tales of the big bad wolf. You know, it's the big bad wolf. And it's the one thing you've got to be really wary of.
So
you have to be, in the folk tales, you have to be very clever to outwit the wolf.
They're a competitor as a sort of top carnivore, but they're also a companion as well, because I mean the wolf isn't the same as the dog, but nevertheless there is a relationship between those things.
So maybe it's the wolf, the reason it's so scary is the wolf is like the dog that's gone wild. because it's packs of dogs. Because we got attacked by this pack of dogs in Sicily. Did I tell you about this?
No.
Oh, fuck. Okay, so we were in Sicily. We'd had a couple of days away from Fran's parents. And we went to this, Fran had hired this like apartment by the sea, right next to this. You could walk down literally like 100 metres onto the beach. You know, it's nice. Mediterranean, so it's nice sandy beaches, but there's not really any waves or anything. It's just like this thing. So we got some peyote and we'd gone down to the beach in the evening, watched the sunset. Fran's got ukulele. We sat there, take a bit of peyote and just sit there and say prayers for the land, for like our connection to that land. Because it's really tricky, Sicily. And so it's like, no, we want to reconnect back to this. Fran wants to reconnect back to this place. It's like her motherland. And I want to find a way to be with her that I can see some value. Because honestly, you just go sometimes and I just go, oh my God, this place, man. It's just intense. Like, that's just a very intense place to sort of be. So it's like, wow. So trying to find value and the good things about it is a good thing. So anyway, we say these prayers. And we start to say this, but Fran starts to say this prayer. We eat this peyote. Fran starts to say this prayer. Just as the sun's gone down, the stars are out, moon's out. It's beautiful, beautiful, like idyllic. And Fran starts to say this prayer about the group of peyote people within Sicily and the whole scene there and all this sort of stuff. And suddenly we look up and we see coming down the beach. It's dark shape, we're on our own, there's no other people on the beach, yeah? Coming down, there's probably 12 dark shapes that are running, and they're running towards us, yeah? And they come down, and it's a pack of wild stray dogs.
Which you get like lots 12 of Mediterranean them. Countries, that's what dogs do, they just form packs, don't they? So.
But we're obviously in their territory, and they want to go to sleep, or, you know, it's like, fuck. And so they start coming and going, whoa! And then they'd like go back and then they'd like skirt around and like two of them would go around one side and then they'd go, wah! And then they start to come in like this and it's like, fucking hell. Okay, so Fran's going, what the fuck? Fucking freaking out, peyote. So it's like, okay, so like, it's all right, we just got to be calm, we're just going to get things, we're just going to gather everything up, we're going to get up, we're going to go, we've got to be calm. These dogs are like coming in, they're going like that, and then it's like fucking hell. They keep making forays in that are getting more and more persistent, and it's like fucking hell. So just walk away, back away, until eventually we sort of get away and just walking away. Fucking hell, man. So it's like right in the middle of peyote ceremony, basically. So it's like fucking hell. So we just go back, calm down, settle down. So it's interesting. So that for me, that's you know, the dog and the wolf are that far apart.
Yeah,
they're that far apart. It's only that our domestication of them and training of dogs from pups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you start to get dogs that aren't trained from pups, and that their parents have had to scavenge to be able to be free, is that fucking hell? You're gonna be hungry for a whole different game. It may as well be the domesticated wolf. It's like, you know, it's there. It's like really interesting.
It's like they say, you know, the wolves say, we've rebranded as dog and outsourced the hunting to the humans. It's completely true. So who else have we got? We've got a fourth.
The magic owl.
And the owl.
The owl. So what I've got, I've been obsessed. Been obsessed with that whole tale of Clu and Blodweth from the Mabinogion.
Mm-hmm.
So I transcribed the whole thing because one of the brilliant things. is that
as you do,
because I want to learn it as a tale because I want to be able to tell it, but I can't quite get my head around the pronunciation. I keep having it. I've got Ronald audio book again. Ronald reading the Mabinogion. Really cool.
Wow.
Really cool. So all the four cycles. Really good. So anyway, the tale of Clu and Blodweth. And so Blodweth was the woman of flowers that Gwydion made for...
Oh, Math and Gwydion.
Yeah. Made for
Llewelogaethus.
That's it, Llewelogaethus. And because he couldn't have a wife, and they didn't think that was fair, so they thought they'd make him one. But she turns out to be completely fucking untrustworthy. Like, she's not this beautiful flower maiden, but she's just like following her heart, so... She just follows her heart and falls in love with his enemy. who then she starts having an affair with. And then basically they plan to kill him. Mm. And so he has to do something like...
Stand on a goat and on a cauldron with something on his head.
And do this. And so she goes, oh, do you know what? I can't see how that would work. Would you? Yeah, show me. Off on a cauldron? That's just what you're talking about. Yeah, show me. Yeah. And obviously she's told her lover to be there, ready with a spear to chuck
at the moment.
So at the moment he goes, duh, look, like this. She goes, God, she chucks his spear. And it hits him straight through the chest and it kills him. But he comes up as an eagle. So he flies up as an eagle. And I've got to try and get this right, so... Bear in mind, I might get it mixed up. There's a Norse myth where Loki gets an eagle that's shedding carrion flesh, or is that?
I think he's shot with an arrow. Does he become an eagle, or he's shot with an arrow? I think that there is a. There's.
I'm not quite sure.
I've got the story inevitably somewhere in the book.
Yeah, I have. But
so where's the owl?
So anyway, so yeah, well, exactly. We're going to get there. So basically. Eventually he gets found again, he's this eagle or whatever, and he gets turned back to life. And Math, the king, says, look, basically you're going to have to get an army, you've got to go, this is not on you, this is what they've done to you, that's not fair. So you get an army together, and they defeat the army of Lugaris, what's his name again? Hlugaris? Hlugaris? What's the word?
Lulagifas.
Yeah. So they slay his army, but they say to him, they say no. This is the whole point, is that they say no. What we're going to do is, I want you to climb up a ladder, stand on a goat, stand on a cauldron, and then I get one shot at you with a spear. And he says, and the guy goes, oh, I won't be okay, only if I can then sort of stand behind this rock, and I have this rock here. And he goes, yeah, okay. So he does. He stands on the cauldron, gets his rock to sort of hide behind, and is it Gwydion? Would it be Gwydion? No. It's the anyway. He throws the spear. It goes through the rock and then through him and kills him dead.
Serves him right.
But the rock, and this is the point. This is one of the points of this, is that the rock is an actual place. So and it's on the river. There's an actual place in Wales where it's got a rock with a hole through it that. He threw his spear through, so it's an actual place you can go to.
Cool.
So it's like the whole thing sort of fits together. But Blodweth, so what they do to Blodweth is that he says, look, I'm going to turn you into the bird that is completely lonely. It's a lonely bird. It exists at night time when all the other birds exist in the daytime. And it's going to be shunned by all the other birds.
Gets mobbed by them, doesn't it?
Yeah, so. Gets shunned by all the other birds. He said, I'm going to turn you into an owl. And then and she gets turned into an owl. And in Wales, the word Blodweth was used for the name for an owl, like right up until like the 1950s or something. So it's like...
And does it mean flower face?
Because this is constructed from flowers.
This is the shape of the owl's face, as this sort of flattened kind of thing. So they're all hunting animals, and they're also a really.
Are they all? The frog? Flies. Wow. Yeah, they are. Oh, interesting.
Well, it's a bone.
It's a bone. That's true. Yeah, that's what it's about. Wow. So yeah, that's the story. So that's the story to be told. And I don't know what's going to happen with that. It's really interesting. I don't know. I'm interested to find out what's going to happen.
That's the story of the making of it.
That's just the beginning. That is the beginning. It's true. That's it. This is where this is from the dream. So essentially what it is that dream manifesting in this world. Whatever that vision was, it's that manifesting in this world.
Very
I really
cool.
like that.
Brilliant.
Press stop.
Yes.